Hello and welcome to The Curator on Monocle Radio with me, Carlotta Ribello. Over the next 60 minutes, we'll be bringing you some of the very best interviews and reports from the past week of coverage across Monocle Radio, with highlights from our studios here at Midori House and in Zurich, and also from around the world. This week, could AI be used to disrupt upcoming elections?
One has to realize that AI is, at the moment, unregulated. You know, we're getting into large language models, but large legal models are missing.
We'll also look at recent protest movement happening in Russia, demanding soldiers come back from the front line. We'll hear about Zimbabwe's new currency and discover if Bollywood could have an impact on India's election too. Plus, we tour Heal's department store in London and talk about its future.
The very first thing we did was spend time with Heal's as a business, understand what they needed and how could we create a new home for them within the building that would stand the test of time and enable them to be here for the next 100 years.
All that, and we also be discovering why whales and dolphins have been given a person status in certain parts of the world. That's all ahead over the next hour here on The Curator with me, Carlotta Ribello. So welcome to The Curator. We started the week with a special edition of The Globalist, hosted by Emma Nelson from our Zurich studio. In it, we delved into the role of artificial intelligence and what it could do in upcoming elections after tech giant Microsoft issued a warning that China could use AI to disrupt the polls. To find out more, Emma was joined by Ali Borhani, a strategy expert and managing director of 360 Strategic Advisors. Let's have a listen.
Well, I think there is a great concern with the power of AI at, you know, states will start dabbling into one another's electoral process and democracies. But one has to realize that, you know, AI is at the moment unregulated. You know, we're getting into large language models, but large legal models are missing. And at the same time, I think U.S. is somehow forgetting that a lot of discourse goes back to the Florida Bush and, you know, Gore era. The erosion of public trust, you know, in electoral process in the United States is something that is the story must be tackled at home. You will see that, you know, with deep fake, with cryptocurrencies, and the fact that in U.S. at the moment everybody's holding their breath as to where Taylor Swift will lay in and weigh in is saying a lot.
No, exactly. So just to explain to us what exactly what the disruption by China actually looks like. How would we spot it, or how would it manifest itself?
It would be very hard, Emma, to be honest with you, because finger pointing is easy, but with technology, many times there are as well, you know, you see in these tools that a state can implicate a third state. So it's a very risky proposition to come out and just to outsource all of it in advance to China. Do United States and China and great powers interfere in each other's affairs? They do. I mean, there's this famous quote that diplomacy is telling somebody to go to hell in a way that, you know, that person actually looks forward to the trip. And I think the fact that the United States would like to say, hey, if anything goes wrong, it's with China, overlooks the complexities of the private capital in the United States. You have many opinionated deep pockets, you know, Peter Thiel, Elon Musk. All of them have their own political convictions and preferences. And AI is unregulated. A lot of it's happening in dark kitchens. And as a matter of fact, in China, you know, technology and AI is strictly overseen and, you know, looked after by the state. In the United States, you have private sector, so it is very easy to point fingers. But at the same time, I think we need a deeper conversation between China and United States as peer competitors, similar to nuclear treaty, because containment, collaboration, and code of conduct are not all, you know, part of the same dish that U.S. can serve. The United States at the moment wants to have an a la carte collaboration with China, but a buffer criticism. And China doesn't work that way. If you look at Kissinger, you look at the diplomacy of 60s and 70s, they have to sit down. They have to talk about a structured treaty in and around AI. Otherwise, we're really, you know, running into shifting sands.
surely this is too late now when we have reports that China attempted an AI-generated disinformation campaign in Taiwan, and now we have the likes of Microsoft stepping up. I mean, sitting down and talking across the table is one thing, but doing something and preventing any interference in elections is a different matter altogether.
Completely, and I couldn't agree more there with you. But one who is familiar with China knows that you need candid, private, respectful, secure conversations. The only thing that at the moment is taking place, if you look at FT's cover today, is that U.S. is warning China on this front, U.S. is warning China on that front. Janet Yellen is giving stern warnings to China on this subject. Chinese need to sit down and talk to Americans. And likewise, the stakes are high for humanity. It's not just about this election, you know. You look at deep fakes and you look at cryptocurrency role in the U.S. election and upcoming elections. There is much more at stake, I think, than just saying, oh, we found, you know, an attempt by Microsoft. Because some of it surfaces, we hear about them. There's a lot more behind the scenes between Beijing and Washington. And they need to sit down and, as I said, have, you know, peer-competitor conversations and have a framework around AI. This is just the beginning. Because think about it, Emma. They're talking about Neuralink. They're talking about brain-computer interface. 12 years ago, 15 years ago, if we were talking about many of these technologies, one would have said, what are you smoking? Are you crazy? These things will come as well. So the question is, if we're not putting the guardrails and having proper conversations state to state about rules of engagement and having the framework in which we do not interfere in each other's affairs, and but at the same time respecting each other's processes in terms of model of governance, those conversations have to take place right now. As I said, the deep pocket, I would say dark kitchens of AI are much more sprouting in the Western Hemisphere. And we have to be very mindful because the private capital in our part of the world at the moment trumps the state's investment, R&D, and control in, you know, AI and artificial intelligence. And as I said, large language models need large legal models around them as well.
Next, we turn to Russia, where a movement formed by the wives of soldiers has started a regular protest, calling for their husbands to be allowed to return home. Georgina Godwin was joined by the Russian analyst and regular Monocle contributor, Stephen Diel, to find out more.
It's called The Way Home, Put Domoy in Russian. They have a very active Telegram channel, Telegram being the social media of choice for many Russians. And it started some months ago with the idea not so much to stop the war, although some of them clearly feel that that would be the best solution for Russia and Russians, but actually to bring home their husbands principally, but also brothers, cousins, uncles, fathers, who were called up under the mobilization announced by President Putin in September 2022 and have never been given leave. So we're talking about more than 18 months now. They've been at the front. They were not regular soldiers. They may have had a little bit of training, but none of them have been allowed home. And so that was what sparked off this movement. And for some months, women have been putting on a white headscarf and at 12 o'clock local time going to their local memorial to the unknown soldier. The main one, of course, is in Moscow, just under the Kremlin walls. But they're across Russia in other cities, and laying flowers. And that was the form of protest. And they've now decided to take this one step further. As of last Saturday, and they're calling for every Saturday, at 5 o'clock on local time, for people to go out on their balconies, or if they're at their dacha, go in the garden of their dacha, and bang saucepans. So they're calling it the March of the Empty Saucepans. Mm. And on last Saturday, at least 20 cities and areas across Russia, women took part in this. Some men took part in this as well. On their Telegram channel, there are various videos that people have sent in. This, of course, is a brave thing to do. It's a demonstration, but they're saying, well, you're at home. Surely the authorities can't arrest you for doing something on your own territory.
Well, we know the authorities can and will do exactly as they like in Russia. So why is the Kremlin leaving them alone?
That's a very good question. My own feeling is that they're wary of these women. And they're wary of the numbers of them. We're talking thousands. Let's keep it in perspective. We're not talking millions of people across the country yet. But nevertheless, when you've got thousands of women who are making a protest, they're perhaps slightly more wary of arresting women, particularly en masse, than they would be arresting men. And there's this feeling that, how do we blame them or say they've committed a crime when all they're doing is either wearing a white headscarf and putting flowers or banging a saucepan? And I think that this is a reflection of President Putin's biggest fear in Russia. His biggest fear, as I've said in this studio before, is not nuclear war. It's not NATO. It's an uprising from below. And when you've got women whose husbands haven't returned, maybe are never going to return because they've already been killed, there's a feeling that they've got nothing to lose. And these women, as we saw in the Afghan war, when a lot of mothers protested and started a real social movement of soldiers' mothers, when they feel that they've lost what's most precious to them, and they say, "What the hell? My husband's dead. My son's dead. What else have I got to lose?" They will fight. Russian women have this reputation for being incredibly tough, and I think that is what is preventing the Kremlin from really pushing hard on them, because it could then spark out of control. And then if you get what the Russians call bunt, this uprising from below, that's what frightens Putin most of all.
And are these women anti-patriotic? Are they against the war?
They very much say that they are patriotic. You do get comments coming back to them on Telegram accusing them of being unpatriotic and using terms that one wouldn't repeat on the radio. But on the whole, they say, no, we're patriotic. What we're asking for is our government to fulfil its obligations. It's just not right to call men up to the army if for whatever reason and then not give them any leave. As I say, that's the starting point is that they're protesting about their loved ones not being allowed home at all for leave, which is in any circumstances very unusual. I mean, in the Second World War, for example, armies were allowed to have soldiers go on leave for R&R, rest and recuperation. But this is not happening at all. And also, of course, we know how brutal the Russian army is being to its own people. Mm. Soldiers who've refused to fight, maybe they've got PTSD, they simply cannot go on, are being thrown into a pit and not fed until they agree to come out and go and fight. The Russians have done some incredibly dreadful and brutal things to Ukrainians in Ukraine and torture and mass rape and so on. But they're actually very cruel to their own people too. And so this is what the women also are saying. Why should my husband be thrown into a pit because he's been on the front line for 18 months and just needs a break?
We know that Russia's desperately short of troops, but what might be the other reasons for not allowing them leave? Is it because they would bring news back from the front line?
I think you're absolutely right, Georgina. I think that is the worry. The Russian authorities have clamped down on any information that doesn't put across the official view that this is not a war but a special military operation, that the Russian army is liberating Russians in Ukraine, that they're fighting Nazis in Ukraine, they're now fighting NATO in Ukraine, all of which is nonsense. The only Nazis in Ukraine are Russian soldiers who've behaved so atrociously. And so anything that actually brings the message back, as happened again in Afghanistan. This was one of the things that the war in Afghanistan lasted for nearly 10 years. And I said this for a long time, and I think it's generally accepted now, not just because I said it, but that the war in Afghanistan played a crucial role in the collapse of the Soviet Union. And one of the reasons was you had soldiers who'd serve out there who were being told they were doing their internationalist duty and then coming back and going back to their villages or towns all over Russia and saying, hey, they were shooting at us. My friend got his arm blown off. And so when the horrors of war do come back, the Russians know from their experience from Afghanistan that this can have a knock-on effect, and it could really cause real trouble amongst the Russian population.
You're listening to The Curator on Monocle Radio with me, Carlotta Ribello. Something that made the news this week was the launch of a new currency by Zimbabwe's government in a bid to fight sky-high inflation. Monocle's Andrew Muller muses on its potential to last.
In 2009, Zimbabwe was the subject of incredulity and or mockery when it issued a $100 trillion bill, the graphics department of the country's Reserve Bank somehow finding sufficient room on the banknotes for the requisite number of zeros. 14, if you're running out of fingers. Such was the state of Zimbabwe's currency at the time that the $100 trillion bill was worth close to nothing. Almost certainly literally less than the paper upon which it was printed. It was the climactic spasm of a period of hyperinflation occasioned by the lunatic economic policies of unlamented tyrant Robert Mugabe, which had turned a country once renowned as Africa's breadbasket into the continent's most abject basket case. Beleaguered Zimbabweans traded jokes borrowed from 1930s Weimar Germany, later revived in 1990s Yugoslavia, about people going to the shops to buy milk with a wheelbarrow full of cash, only to be preyed upon by muggers who took the wheelbarrow and left the money.
Oh no.
The Zimbabwean dollar was understandably abandoned shortly afterwards, Zimbabweans preferring to conduct business in US dollars, South African rand, Botswanan pula, and euros, among other currencies. A new Zimbabwean dollar was introduced in 2019, but nobody much trusted that either, and it has substantially lapsed into disuse after losing three-quarters of its value this year. Or, given the reliance of a given currency on the belief of consumers and traders, has lost three-quarters of its value this year because it substantially lapsed into disuse. So for a decade and a half, Zimbabwe has effectively been a member of that exclusive coterie of countries which do not have an official currency of their own, alongside a few appropriators of the euro, Kosovo, Montenegro, and a smattering of European micronations, and other borrowers of the US dollar, including Ecuador, El Salvador, and Timor-Leste. Another one to watch here is Argentina, whose rambunctious president, Javier Milei, still claims to be determined to implement his election promise of abandoning the inflation-stricken Argentinian peso for the American greenback. In theory, however, Zimbabwe will get a new currency to call its own this week. It is the ZiG. Officially, if annoyingly written as capital Z, lowercase I, capital G, the name is an abbreviation of Zimbabwe Gold. The name is significant. Upon the introduction of the ZiG, Zimbabwe will become the only country in the world with a currency backed by gold. The gold standard, that is, the tying of a currency to precious metal, hasn't really been a thing for a while. It was quite common until the Great Depression of the 1930s, after which policymakers began to seek more flexible options. The last country to leave the gold standard was Switzerland in 1999, though Switzerland does retain the world's seventh largest holding of the stuff.
We want a solid and stable national currency for this country. It hasn't happened for many years, and it's time we had that in place. We want a stable and sustainable exchange rate. We want robust policy credibility and restoration of market confidence.
Zimbabwe's Reserve Bank hopes that pinning the ZiG to gold, as well as reserves of other minerals and foreign currencies, will promote trust in the new currency and persuade Zimbabweans to return to the formal financial sector instead of taking their chances with the unsafe, uncheckable, untaxable, unofficial practices which have become locally known as mattress banking. As of this week's announcement, Zimbabweans will have 3 weeks to trade whatever current Zimbabwean dollars they have been buoying their slumbers with for ZiGs, which they can use to buy a new mattress.
We have not changed anything, and I think as long as we don't address production with a big informal sector, which has got its own informal rules, its own governor, its own mattress bank, it's not banking money, so how are you going to influence change? In terms of currency stability.
The pitch for the ZiG, made by John Mushayavanyu, the governor of Zimbabwe's Reserve Bank, is that the old-school linkage to gold will mitigate against Zimbabwe's still chronic inflation, currently running somewhere around north of 55%, which is actually a considerable improvement on this time last year, when it was 87%, by making it impossible for the government to simply print more money, as it has done repeatedly in the past, despite mountainous evidence to the effect that this, at least past a certain point, has a tendency to create more problems than it solves, and indeed can ruin your currency to the extent that the only point in holding the banknotes is the hope of selling them online as novelty bookmarks a few years down the track. You can pick up a used Zimbabwean $100 trillion note on eBay for around 99 pence just now, by an order of magnitude more than it was worth when printed. Skeptics have been heard to mutter that the ZiG may be scuppered by a different inbuilt weakness, in that Zimbabwe's current gold reserves are relatively meagre, perhaps one tonne of gold or equivalent in the Reserve Bank's vaults, another tonne and a half stored elsewhere. By way of contrast with another poor-to-poorish country with a similar population, around 16 million or so, Cambodia presently holds 20 times as much gold as that. But while Zimbabwe has learned the hard way that printing more money doesn't work, Zimbabwe can theoretically mine more gold. It presently ranks 21st among the world's gold-producing nations. For the moment, at least, Zimbabwean authorities seem keen to have a few zigs each way, which is to say that other currencies will still be allowed to circulate. Zimbabweans who were alive at independence in 1980 have seen five currencies collapse. There seems to be some awareness at large that it might take them a while to place much faith in a sixth. For Monocle Radio, I'm Andrew Muller.
To Greece now, where the Delphi Economic Forum has been taking place all week. Monocle's team on the ground has been exploring the rising challenge of populism in Europe and whether Greece's own emergence from crisis in just 10 years holds lessons for other countries. Monocle's Andrew Muller spoke with Greek political scientist and author Takis Pappas and began by asking if there's a reason why some countries are more prone to populism than others.
Greece is the country in which populism grew very, very strong. That was the first country in post-war Europe in which populism came into power. That was back in 1981, and that was a left kind of populism. And we have had a recurrence of populist phenomena in Greece, in this country, by both left and right-wing governments or coalitions like, you know, Syriza and the independent Greeks more recently. Now, what do you have there in all of the cases of populism, if you ask for one common denominator, is charismatic leadership. You always have a leader who is charismatic. Now, the thing is, how do you define charisma? That is easy again, because all charismatic leaders or all populist charismatic leaders have either had a party of their own or conquered a party, like Trump, for example.
Sure.
So they, all of them have a party which they use in order to capture power and then exercise power. So charisma, agency, leadership is the vital characteristic of all populist movements or parties, no exception.
Is leadership ever an antidote to populism, though? Because this will not be a new idea to you, but there has been a lot of suggestion that the government of Kyriakos Mitsotakis here has served as kind of an antidote to populism, possibly a template for how it can be pushed back against. I interviewed Mitsotakis a couple of months ago in Munich. He did slightly waspishly say that he had the advantage that in Greece the populists had been allowed to govern, and he was able to demonstrate that instead here is what actual competence looks like.
Yes, there is a template, actually. But let me go back to populism. What is populism? What do we mean by that? By populism, I mean a leader who promises to his people. Usually it is men. I mean, we're talking about men. I mean, all populist leaders who have governed are men. You don't have women, as far as I know. Now, those people promise their people to rule their countries, disrespecting the institutions, serving the interest of the people. That is the main idea. So the main idea of populism is a leader who rules even against institutions. Now, the template for a non-populist, a moderate, a liberal leader to emerge is to stick to the institutions, okay, and promise that he is going to do the job by sticking to the institutions, essentially, and he has to convince the people to vote for him. Because, let us not forget that, populists are not non-democrats. They're democrats. Okay, they play by the rules of the electoral game. So the distinction here is is between those leaders who play by the institutions and those who play against institutions, illiberal democracy, hence populism.
I mean, does it surprise you, though, that the appeal is recurrent, that there does always seem to be a market for it? Because the record of populists of any sort of actually being able to govern when they win elections is, well, it's fairly slender. They usually get into power, screw everything up, blame everybody else, and then get turfed out of power until they come back again. But they always do seem to find a way to come back. There's always an appetite for it.
They do. Of course, there is always an appetite for it because, you know, people do not like the institutions. The institutions require from you to be a responsible citizen. Who wants that, after all? I mean, look at the United States. So populism is a recurrent phenomenon since the 19th century. You always have that at the regional level, at the state level, at the national level, until Trump, of course. So once you have a populist situation or a populist regime or a populist government in a state like Greece, for example, there's a memory of that. And usually that memory is not a bleak memory. It's a fond memory. People remember that period as a period in which, you know, the people did whatever they wanted, actually. So this is why in Greece, for example, the Greek people remember very fondly the 80s. Okay, the period under the leadership of Andreas Papandreou. But that was the period in which, you know, growth was the most sluggish in Greece. Okay, but people think about that period very, very fondly, and, you know, they remember that period. And they say it was one of the best periods in our lives as a nation, as a people, etc., etc. So there is an appeal to populism. There is some magic there.
Ahead of India's election, a new wave of Bollywood films has hit cinemas. These movies promote polarizing issues to further the Hindu nationalist agenda of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Industry insiders tell us that this is anything but a novel election strategy. It is the latest in a series of efforts to crack down on opposition, and Modi has his sights set firmly on India's influential movie business and the 2 billion tickets it sells every year. The government has been increasing its interventions in Bollywood, using tax breaks to promote some films while strengthening its legislative powers to ensure the wrong messages don't make it on screen. Monocle Radio's George Ruskin has the story.
The sound of Bollywood is changing. The industry, known for its epic tales, has become a platform for the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party to promote its Hindu nationalist agenda as India approaches elections next week. Bollywood is arguably India in microcosm, where Hindu nationalism is emerging as an indisputable truth. A new wave of films glorifies Hindu figures and ideas, making villains of Muslims, leftists, and opposition figures. Now showing across the country is Swatantra Veer Savarkar, the biopic of Veer Savarkar, the revered Hindu nationalist politician who rejected Gandhi's ideology of non-violence in the struggle for independence. Savarkar's call to arms to Hindus is ramped up in the movie, chiming perfectly with Modi's hardline message to voters on the campaign trail. This is, however, just one of many such films that have been released in recent months. I spoke to Rajesh Sen, an Indian film critic, and asked him what Hindu nationalism looks like on screen.
There are a few basic themes that we see a lot of. One is that there is a narrative being built that is historical about the Hindu rulers. They are being valorized regardless of what the history books say. There is a significance being given to them that may be disproportionate to what actually happened. And there is also an otherization of the rulers from other minorities, largely the Muslim rulers, the invaders. They are shown as barbaric, as demonic.
It's not just historical biopics where we are seeing this propaganda deployed. Contemporary issues have also been turned into films.
And in current Hindi cinema, we are seeing a lot of divisiveness. There is a big idea at the heart of all the propaganda films, which is that the Hindu is a very wronged person and that he is under threat in his own nation. And I think that is the insecurity that the propaganda films are playing up.
Most alarming, perhaps, is a trend of new expose films. They are seen as attempts to rewrite recent history, often laundering Modi's personal reputation.
It's rather shoddily made, badly directed, often poorly acted. These are tacky productions, but that's what makes them like the cinematic equivalent of a WhatsApp forward, because they are purporting to tell the audience something that they claim has been kept from them. It's trying to rile up the audience. And somewhere that outrage is easily tapped into. I think the audiences are taking to them because they are not considering it like cinema. They're not saying, oh, this is not a good film or a bad film. They're saying, oh, this is what I've learned from this film. So it is basically misinformation being spread across on a large scale.
A current exposé film seeks to revise the Gaja train fire in 2002, a low point in Modi's political career. He was chief minister of Gujarat when the train disaster was whipped up into anti-Muslim riots that left over 1,000 people dead. The film's title? Accident or Conspiracy Gajra. Despite criticism of bias and inaccuracies, these politically aligned films have enjoyed massive commercial success. Endorsements from the top of the BJP have led to tax exemptions on cinema tickets and mass screenings being held. This demonstrates the close nexus between Bollywood and political power. Filmmakers have described to me a stifling creative atmosphere. Dissenting voices in the industry are facing growing pressure from the government and Hindu nationalist groups aligned to Modi. Onir, a multi-award-winning Bollywood director, told me that he has had to resort to self-censorship.
More than the time and effort you spend on writing a script right now is the time you spend with lawyers to know if anything you're writing or talking about is problematic or might be considered problematic. People will constantly say, if you're going to a platform or something, that they want to do nothing political. At the same time, actually what it means is anything that questions the government is considered to be political.
Oni represents a small group of Bollywood directors resisting the diktat. He made a name for himself in the more liberal mid-2000s with LGBT films like My Brother Nikhil and I Am. He is committed to challenging the new status quo, but faces growing challenges.
I was trying to make a film which was based on a real-life story of an army major set in Kashmir. There was this new law that if you have anyone from the army being represented in film, that you have to pass your script through the Ministry of Defense. So I sent my script to the Ministry of Defense and it was rejected. I was not told why. And then 3 months later, it was discussed in the parliament where it was mentioned that it was derogatory for the army, a threat to the security of the country.
Parliamentary scrutiny of individual films has made studios of all sizes nervous to produce movies with risky narratives and critical messages.
It's becoming really, really difficult because earlier there would be something which is more the independent space. But suddenly, if the spaces of how you put your voice out are all shut out for you, you know, like earlier, come what may, you could put your film out in the theater. It might do well or not well, but it's out there to have the discourse, or you can put it out in a platform. But increasingly, I've heard of filmmakers being blacklisted by platforms, blacklisted by studios. So how are they going to because filmmaking is not inexpensive.
I asked on air whether this censorship could make him leave Mumbai for freer creative environments. He told me that filmmakers like him should stay and fight.
I feel that while it's important to tell stories, it's also important to tell these stories so that it reaches to the people in India, because you're making it for them, because ultimately they're the ones who can bring about the change. It cannot be external, it has to be internal.
The intersection of Bollywood with politics reflects a broader trend of polarization in India's socio-political landscape. Many filmmakers have decided to align with the Hindu nationalist narrative, out of fear, or in hope of commercial success, or even just a foot in the door for funding. In a country as diverse as India, cinema has the power to unite or divide. The choices made by filmmakers resonate far beyond the silver screen, shaping public discourse, political narratives, and perhaps even the outcome of the general election. As the clock ticks towards this upcoming election, one thing is clear. Bollywood is no longer just about entertainment. It's a battleground for ideas, where the stakes are higher than ever before. For Monocle Radio, I'm George Ruskin.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
This is The Curator, our weekly highlights show here on Monocle Radio, and I'm Carlotta Ribello. Heels is a big part of the history of London. Having taken up shop in the 1800s, the Tottenham Court Road space is known for its spiral staircase and the resident cat, and holds countless stories of manufacture, craft and retail in the city. Today, the retail space isn't quite as sprawling as it once was, and the recent transformation of the unused portions of the store by the firm General Projects will see a vast amount of office space become available in this historic building. For this week's episode of The Urbanist, Monocle's Andrew Tuck went for a tour of the newly transformed Heels and sat down for a chat with General Project CEO Jacob Loftus. He began by asking about his firm and why they certainly aren't just looking for an easy wins when it comes to real estate.
We are definitely not looking for the easy wins. We look to make our lives as complicated and difficult as possible by trying to buy sometimes unloved, sometimes misunderstood, always very complicated buildings that we think have the potential to become interesting, exciting, innovative, creative buildings that ultimately we can redesign and reinvent entirely around the end user who's going to engage with it. I think real estate is kind of the only industry in the world where people create something that they don't think of as a product and don't really prioritize designing it around the needs of the end user. People tend to follow a formula in this industry. And for us, it's about creating a user experience in everything we do.
Now, we're on Tottenham Court Road. Tottenham Court Road, for people who are not London, is right in the heart of London, runs down to Oxford Street. It was traditionally known as a home for furniture stores, and it still is, this building on the ground floor, home to one of the most famous tenants of this street, Heels. Tell us about this building, or this multitude of buildings, and how you found them.
Heels, as you say, is one of the UK's most well-known and iconic furniture businesses. They started life here in the 1800s doing two things. They had a series of workshops and smaller buildings at the back of the site, which they manufactured all of their furniture, from cabinets to beds to sofas and curtains. And then at the front of the block facing Tottenham Court Road, they built a very grand, beautiful department store. And as time has evolved, they stopped manufacturing from here, but still continued very much selling from here. And we got an opportunity a couple of years ago to be able to buy the entirety of the site. So the grand department store at the front and this collection of amazing old industrial warehouse and workshop buildings at the back. And the vision we're hopefully going to be able to execute is to transform what was a building that kind of stood for the best of British design furniture making for the last 100 years, hopefully transform it into a building that will still very much be a home for Heels, but also can become a home to a variety of different office users, hopefully all of whom share that same British spirit of design, creativity and innovation. And hopefully we can create this lovely urban campus, stitching all of these buildings together and bringing a really cool and creative, diverse community into it.
As we walked around the site, it's going to be home to a lot of companies. I believe almost a dozen are already signed up or already here. And Heels have moved, they were on two floors, they've moved down to the ground floor. There was some vacant space there as well. What's your logic of how the building is going to work? What's it going to do?
So I think the starting point for us was we wanted to ensure that anything we were going to do with this building would ensure that the Heels business would remain at the heart of it. I think there are a lot of stories going on at the moment around department stores being redeveloped, retail businesses having to close. Obviously, the high street's a tough sector. And I think for us, the idea of the Heels building without Heels didn't sit right. So the very first thing we did was spend time with Heels as a business, understand what they needed and how could we create a new home for them within the building that would stand the test of time and enable them to be here for the next 100 years. There was some empty retail space at ground floor. And for us, we thought the whole of the Tottenham Court Road frontage has got to be Heels. So the anchor of this project and the North Star heart will always be Heels being in the ground and basement and having this amazing furniture emporium. The rest of the building is much more around the future of work and trying to create a range of different, unusual, characterful, creative offices like the one we're sitting in now, which is all about trying to embrace the history and culture and quirks of this building, because it is a very quirky and unusual building. No two spaces are the same, and trying to just embrace that to create a variety of different shapes and sizes to allow cool, interesting businesses to have a home that they're inspired by and absolutely love coming to every day.
Well, as you walked us around, there are courtyard gardens, there are roof gardens, there are light wells, there are unusual spaces, there's definitely stairs up and down between levels. 2-3 years ago, even here in London, people would have been cautious about a big bet on new office space. But the story is getting quite interesting now that, especially here in the centre of London, it feels like many people want to relocate here from what was thought to be the cooler neighbourhoods a little bit further out. What's the story that you're seeing about office space? Because obviously this is a brave move, or is it actually just you're anticipating what the market's going to look like?
We're incredibly confident and excited about the project, so we don't see it as brave at all. We think it's quite an obvious move. I'm sure there are probably a lot of other people who didn't see it that way and definitely think it's a bit brave, but that's probably the same thing most people would say about most of our projects. In reality, we don't necessarily take the traditional, well-trodden path.
But the trend, you see the trend as returning to office space?
I think the world has very much accepted that the questions around work from home and what would happen post-pandemic, we have moved back to a physical working environment. People want to collaborate, they want to be creative, they want to engage with the teams that they work with and their colleagues. So I think the future of work is definitely in person, albeit with a lot more flexibility and the ability to work from home here and there when you need it, because that's the environment we're in. But I think most companies are now focused on how do we create and foster an environment that is inspiring to our staff, that gets people talking, that makes them feel creative, that makes them want to come to the office. Because we all know that if we need to, we can sit at home in front of a screen, conduct video calls for 12 hours a day and can get by without coming to the office. So the need to come to the office needs to be a desire, and to create that desire and allow people to be at their best and be most productive and be collaborative is hopefully by being in amazing spaces that instigate that and drive that natural reaction. And that's what we're trying to create.
I've heard the phrase a little bit over the last few weeks about buildings that earn the commute, that you can't have a dull building, expect people to rock up and be joyful when they come through the front door. What is it about old buildings? Because it's fascinating, isn't it, that when you think about all these cool young companies starting up, they don't seek out the most slick, modern offices usually. They like places with some kinks and quirks and heritage. Is that something that you feel underpins the kind of market that you're going for?
Definitely. Almost all the projects that we're involved in as a business are taking old industrial, Victorian, historic buildings and trying to repurpose them into interesting new places. And I think there's a sense of character, authenticity, creativity that naturally is created by repurposing an old building that's very hard to replicate in a new building, particularly the traditional conventional glass and steel rectangular boxes that have characterized the way we've worked for the last 40 or 50 years. But I think that is changing, and in today's world there's something a lot more inspiring and also comforting. It feels warm and nice to be in an old building, whereas it feels quite clinical and uninspiring to be in a lot of the newer buildings that are created. But that's not to say that new buildings can't achieve what old buildings are. I think it's not the way the industry and the world has evolved them. But I think that potentially could start to change quite soon too.
Now, one of America's leading food publications is back in business, 3 years after it seemed to have disappeared for good. Savour magazine has not appeared in print since February 2021. That's when it ended a 27-year run that had brought Americans closer to international cuisine than ever before. The magazine transported readers to every region of the world, and it shows chefs and home cooks across the US that there is far more to life than cheeseburgers, barbecue, Tex-Mex, or America's version of Chinese food. Now, one pandemic and an economic downturn later, Savour is back, as Washington-based reporter Simon Marks explains.
We're at our holiday party, and we wanted to ask our friends, do you know how to pronounce the name of our magazine?
They've always been a lively bunch at Savour magazine, and 12 years ago at the publication's Christmas party, they made no attempt to hide it. So how did the guests get along?
Savour?
I prefer Savour. I think it sounds fancier.
Savour. But out in the West, sometimes I hear people say Savoir.
Savour?
People say Savour.
If I were in France, I would probably say Savour. But since I'm in America, I say Savour, and probably the strangest way that I've ever heard it pronounced is Savior, which I gotta say is a little weird but also kind of wonderful.
More than a decade later, it is also very apt, because Savour magazine has found its savior in the form of Kat Craddock.
I came from the restaurant industry before I moved over to media, and Savour was always really important to me, and I wanted to make sure that it continued. And we see magazines all the time folding and brands folding all the time. And I didn't want that to happen to us.
She is a former contributor to the magazine who is now its brand new editor-in-chief after taking the very bold and entrepreneurial decision to try and save it from the publishing scrap heap. She had watched Savour sold to new owners during the pandemic and then watched them scale back the magazine's operations and cancel its print run. A move that disappointed loyal subscribers whose enthusiasm for Savour and loyalty to the brand convinced Kat Craddock that there was something worth salvaging.
Savour has kind of always been a little bit more niche and a little bit weirder than other mass food brands. And that's not to say, I mean, it breaks my heart every time any food publication folds. And, you know, every quarter or every year when this happens, it's really disappointing for the whole industry. But, you know, I meet folks in the food and beverage industry all the time, whether they're chefs or food producers or restaurant owners, who tell me that they're longtime Savour readers and that they ended up in their line of work because of this publication. And I don't hear that about other brands.
If you need a lot of iceberg lettuce for salads or topping tacos, you want to remove the core to make chopping easier.
In addition to the magazine, she has also inherited Savour's massive archive of digital assets, including thousands of recipes and how-to videos.
So take a head of iceberg lettuce, make sure the core is pointing down, and slam it. Turn the head over and remove the core. It's just that easy.
Now, while that may be easy, some of Savour's classic recipes have required not just skill, but a fair bit of endurance, introducing Americans to a wide range of ingredients with which many of them were almost certainly unfamiliar.
Today, into the Savour kitchen, we are cooking with one of my favorite cheese of all the time, Montazio. Montazio is a delicious, creamier, nuttier cheese, perfect for melting, coming from the northeast region of Italy.
The magazine will continue its tradition of telling readers where they can acquire products that may not line the shelves of their nearest supermarket. And the first edition of the new print run includes the magazine's hallmark, richly photographed features from, among other places, Marseille, Japan, Lebanon, Italy, California, and even the moon, for an article about what humans might one day eat up there. Its editor says over the three decades since Savour first appeared, tastes in America have massively changed.
You're absolutely right. There were a lot of ingredients and techniques that at the time may have seemed really foreign to our readers. But, you know, our first cover story was about Oaxaca. And there's a whole section in there about how you can't get mezcal in the United States. Well, 30 years later, it's one of the most popular spirits in the United States, you know, and I think that pushing those boundaries and getting those traditions out to a wider audience is noble and exciting. And, you know, we really love to be a part of that.
And she says while several other food and drink magazines in the United States also did not survive the pandemic nor the earlier audience shift to digital, it's the right time to relaunch a print product in a country where newspapers like the New York Times now see their food sections driving subscriptions and becoming, well, the meat and potatoes of their existence.
One thing that came out of the pandemic, obviously the pandemic was a horrible situation, but people that came out of the pandemic came out much better cooks and much more adventurous cooks. And I think a lot more of people's time and energy and focus went into cooking for themselves at that time. And I think there are more adventurous people out there now that are willing to try new things. And I would love to tap into that. And we have a lot of loyal readers who've been with us from the very beginning, but of course I would like to find new readers as well.
Kat Craddock acknowledges the scale of the task she has set herself and her colleagues. Initially, the magazine will be published just twice a year, with digital content and emailed newsletters used to spread awareness of Sevier's return. It's a courageous project and a worthy effort to get readers to, in the words of the magazine's new tagline, "Eat the World." However you pronounce its name.
Sevier. Everybody's saying Sevier. It's Sevier. It's not correct.
Sevier.
That's a pretty good answer to that question. The sound of a plate breaking is how I pronounce the name of a magazine I can't pronounce.
For Monocle Radio, I'm Simon Marks in Washington.
This is The Curator, our weekly highlights show here on Monocle Radio. Now, indigenous leaders in New Zealand, Tonga, French Polynesia and the Cook Islands have drawn up a document that recognises cetaceans as legal persons. Conservationists say granting personhood status is not about claiming that whales and dolphins are human, but recognising that they have rights just as people do. To find out more, Georgina Godwin was joined by Lillene Paul, who's a novelist, playwright, screenwriter, and most recently the author of POD, a cetacean epic, an imagined story based in real environment science and marine biology. Let's have a listen.
It's very exciting news to me because it shows that we protect what we love and we protect what we need to survive. And the so-called less developed nations are closer, probably, to those ancient beliefs which we are rediscovering about the validity of other ways of living, other life forms. And it's fascinating that cetaceans have been granted this personhood by the oceanic nations that stretch from Hawaii to New Zealand.
And what do you think those nations hope to achieve by having granted this status?
Well, I was thinking about this, and they see, for instance, in Hawaii, there's this wonderful word, ohana, which means family, and it extends not just to your immediate human family, but your community, and beyond your community, the creatures with whom you share your world. And so it is a recognition that our world is so much bigger than our limited human life, and I think we are all having to, willingly or not, accept that in order to survive. Mm. And of course, there are some creatures it's easier to love than others. And the great charismatic megafauna are definitely in that category.
Now, in your wonderful book, POD, which was shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction last year, you explore the true meaning of family, of belonging, of sacrifice, the harmony and the tragedy of the POD. And you look at it within an ocean that's no longer the sanctuary that it once was, and which reflects a world that's all too recognisable as our own. And the world is recognisable as our own, but so too are the protagonists. And I wonder why you made the decision to call the all marine characters, two different dolphin species, whales, even different fish, people. I mean, clearly you have some sympathy with the idea of legal personhood for cetaceans then.
It was a more intuitive decision, which then made the writing so much easier, because cetaceans, dolphins, whales, orcas, we know, they're completely social animals. And they live in family groups, they live in pods, and to put them into solitary confinement is a terrible thing. And I did a lot of research on many cetacean species, and it became very apparent the parallels with human existence, with human social existence, were just so obvious. And scientists are very wary of using emotional words like love, for instance. Let's just go straight there. But we know that cetaceans grieve. We know that there is no other realistic explanation for how, for instance, they attend their dead. We have observed in hippos and elephants strange behavior about the death of a calf or the death of a herd member. And it really doesn't seem a stretch at all to give other species the ability to feel. Anyone with a pet will know this.
Absolutely. I wonder how your readers have reacted to this. I mean, the book has been tremendously popular.
Well, it's great because some people are, they love it, and other people have been furious with me for upsetting them about the facts that are in the book. So they are angry with me for making them confront the terrible state of our oceans and what we are doing to the creatures that we share this planet with. But then an amazing thing happens, which is some of them come back and say, I'm still really angry, but I'm now angry about the situation and I'm telling people to read this book.
Which is wonderful. I mean, do you think our connection to the natural world is getting better or worse?
Both. You know, the best of times and the worst of times. At the same time that we are celebrating, let's say, the Declaration of Personhood, which means the indivisible right of a living being to be recognized as such, we're also continuing in our less than merry way of intensive animal farming and the shocking fact of live export. And we still can separate our minds from animals that we want to look after and places in the world that we want to look after and things that we turn a blind eye to. And we are now at a stage of environmental degradation where we can no longer do that and we have to wake up. And I think the oceanic nations, Costa Rica, who have recognized, is it bees? I think it is bees in Costa Rica.
And of course, that was your first book, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. Set in a beehive and based in real biology. And there's brilliant work being done at Imperial College on bee language. Bees have vocabulary. We don't yet know what it is. And there is amazing work being done in, what is it called? Dominica, the SETI project by Shane Giro, about a machine language studying the language of sperm whales. So the largest predator on Earth, the sperm whale, has a static population off the coast of Dominica, and it's being studied by their language is being studied by AI. And it is quite possible, Georgina, that in our lifetime we are going to have a breakthrough and be able to understand at least what this population of sperm whales might be saying.
Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's edition of The Curator. The show was produced by David Stevens and presented by me, Carlotta Rabello. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of the programmes across Monocle Radio. Goodbye, and thanks for listening.